and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. to hear our live broadcast from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by our friends and colleagues at WWOZ in New Orleans. We'll have access to 5 stages of fantastic traditional and contemporary New Orleans jazz and blues, brass bands, and interviews and commentary by the best that WWOZ has to offer. That's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival starting Monday, April 27th. The weekdays will broadcast it from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, will broadcast the festival from noon to 5 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. You're listening to music by Ramzi Hussein Habredwan, who's had a remarkable journey. First as a child raised in a refugee camp in Ramallah, he became a symbol of the first intifada when he was photographed throwing a stone at a tank. Then he discovered a love of music that inspired him to become a renowned international musician. He then founded a music school in the West Bank to teach other young people the power of music. Today we talk with a longtime friend of mine, Sandy Tolan. He's written a literary nonfiction book about Ramzi Hussein Habredwan. As an award-winning radio producer and co-founder of Homelands Productions, Sandy Tolan has traveled throughout the Middle East to produce stunning documentaries. The Lemon Tree tells 60 years of Israeli and Palestinian history through the relationship of an Arab and Jewish family. He later turned that documentary into a book, also called The Lemon Tree. Sandy's written another powerful new book. It's called Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. This book tells the story of Ramzi Habredwan, but it's also a history of the long-running Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Sandy Tolan talked with me from the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where he's an associate professor. Hey, Sandy, welcome to Stage and Studio.
Hey, Dima, nice to talk to you again.
I've known you for years as a radio producer, and your documentary productions are so impeccable. I mean, I'm just in awe of every radio piece and documentary you've produced. But I have to say that reading your writing has been quite an honor for me. And Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, it goes beyond reporting. It truly is a documentary book on so many levels, and it's both a personal story, but also this book is such a broad-sweeping history of the Palestinian and Israeli conflict. How difficult was it for you to alternate between the greater history and the personal stories?
Well, first of all, Dima, thank you so much for those kind, really, really kind words. I appreciate it so much. And having known you for so long and known your great work, it's an honor to hear you say that. I think you've identified one of the biggest challenges in the book is how to mix the personal and the personal history of Ramzi and the history in the context of the larger Israeli-Palestinian struggle and the Palestinian struggle for freedom with that larger context itself. And sometimes I've had to look at it in terms of sort of zooming in and zooming out. The picture has a lot of very tight close-ups of Ramzi, starting at age 5 as he was abandoned by his mother the day that his mother and father were granted a divorce. And he rode home in a little vegetable cart pushed by his uncle in the rain, you know, and then going out and explaining a little bit about the reasons for the first Palestinian Intifada. And in order to do that, you have to talk about the War of 1948, which the Israelis call their War of Independence, and the Palestinians, 750,000 of whom either fled or were driven out of old Palestine, call the Nakba, or the catastrophe. To the extent that I could tie that to Ramzi's own family And certainly his own grandparents were expelled themselves in 1948 by the Israeli army and forced into exile. Ramzi was raised by them in a refugee camp. So there's ways that you can tell the story where it overlaps, the personal and the political, so to speak, the historical and the family story do intersect. But there are times where I had to sort of go out, and I wanted to try to have a voice that would be seen as fair in terms of telling the broader story, but also honor Ramzi's story. Unlike The Lemon Tree, my previous book, which was really the story of two people, one Israeli and one Palestinian, this is more of a history of the occupation of the Palestinians as experienced by young musicians as Ramzi tries to build his music school. And it starts really as a biography of Ramzi's childhood. So I did go back and forth a lot, but I always wanted to go back fairly quickly to the personal story of Ramzi, his family, and some of the kids that then joined him in the effort to build this music school in the occupied West Bank.
And you've done that so beautifully, I have to say. And when you talk about having to start way, way back, since when the Jewish peoples arrived in after World War II, you have at the front of your book these maps, and you show, I guess, the degrees of occupation during that time period from 1947 up until present day. And it's really startling to see the takeover of lands. I guess as somebody who's, a bystander, not necessarily following in depth, except what we get from topical news, that you really see the seriousness of the occupation. And I think that really sets a tone for what you've just talked about.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it is striking to view the conflict graphically. I mean, I try to describe in detail the human costs of occupation, especially on children, like when a 10-year-old girl is told to step out of the van at a checkpoint and pull her violin out of her case and play a song for a soldier, for an Israeli soldier at the checkpoint. But there is a certain utility, I guess you could say, in actually having these maps side by side, the maps you mentioned, the five of them. It's striking that as many forests, metaphorically or literally, have fallen in newsprint in telling this story, as much as we hear about the history of Israel and the U.S. relationship with Israel, it's striking to me that so few people really know about the human costs on half of the population of this conflict, of this Israeli-Palestinian struggle. And the fact that the restrictions of movement have become so severe and the Palestinians are increasingly forced into small pockets in what you almost could compare to an archipelago of islands, or live under direct military occupation in the West Bank, which comprises 60% of the West Bank that is under military occupation. And then just the human terms of what that means on a day-to-day basis. It's the antithesis of freedom. And I think in order to solve the problem, I think what's important for us in America is to understand that we need a broader conversation. We need to change the conversation to include this complete understanding, or at least a much fuller understanding, of what it means to live under occupation for now going on 48 years in the West Bank.
I think some of that is also graphic in your descriptions of, it's not really a fence. It's a wall that divides, that keeps changing between the Palestinian lands and the Israeli lands in the Gaza. And just your descriptions of these checkpoints that people have to go through. And there are photos in there that look to me like, you're herding cattle into a stockyard. And I hate to be, that blunt about it, but that's my reaction to it. And it's those are glimpses that I guess we haven't really seen as much, or we're not privy to just in mainstream media. I don't feel like that I have been. And so your book has really detailed how one person could be divided within even a neighborhood in a village or a relative and have to go for miles when they're actually just next door, but they're separated by this wall. They'd have to go to miles and wait hours in order to be able to see a family member that they're a close friend that they're divided from. Those are really stark. I mean, we're not even talking about the personal story here. These are really stark and detailed descriptions that I feel like perhaps we haven't really known about as much, and I'm not sure exactly why.
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons, and I've been writing about this and trying to emphasize what I see as a need for a broader conversation. I think a lot of people in the United States, Jew and Gentile alike, have been raised with what I call the Leon Uris history of Israel and the Arab world, which is to say that it's the story of the heroic birth of Israel out of the ashes of the Holocaust, and that's basically it. That we see we do not see the Palestinians as people. They're known generally as Arabs, and they're either seen as sort of murderous or pathetic. That's how they're portrayed. For example, in Uris's mega best-selling book Exodus. And to a certain extent, I think that's the history that people understand. Not to say that it's all wrong, but it's so terribly incomplete. And that's what I think we need to re-examine. I think today the so-called Uber narrative of most of the American press, with many notable exceptions, is that Israel needs to be secure. Now, of course, I think few people would disagree with that, but what does that mean? Does it mean that Palestinians therefore don't have the right to be safe and secure and free? And does one freedom come at the cost of another's? I would say no. And I think understanding that the confinement that people in the Palestinian occupied territories, both in the West Bank and Gaza, which is effectively occupied by having been closed. A lot of people call it the largest open air prison in the world. Until we understand what the human costs of that are, I don't think that there'll be enough influence on either the American leadership or the pressure it might come to bear on the Netanyahu government to actually change the facts on the ground. And I think by bringing out the facts of the occupation in the story of these children that are simply trying to learn music, I think maybe it's a way, I hope anyway, to open the heart a little bit.
Well, let's talk about the children who are learning to make music and who are making music. Tell us about the first time that you met the main focus of the story, which is Ramzi Hussein Abu-Redwan. And would you tell us about the first time you met him?
Yes. In fact, I was in the West Bank at the time working on what became The Lemon Tree, the radio documentary that aired on Fresh Air in 1998 and then later became a book that was published in 2006. And during that time, I kept seeing these posters all around Ramallah. And there was a picture of a little boy, 8 years old, as I learned later, throwing a stone at an unseen Israeli soldier during the first Palestinian uprising or intifada started in December of 1987. And this picture was snapped in the early months of the Intifada. And alongside that, in the same poster, was the picture of a young man pulling his viola bow across the strings of a viola. It was the same guy. And as I later learned, in Al-Amari refugee camp, where he lived and was raised in the refugee camp with his grandparents right near Ramallah, it was the same person, Ramzi Hussein Abu-Redwan, and I began to get to know him and did a piece actually back in 98 when he was then 18 years old for NPR for Weekend Edition. And then I kept in touch with him. And during that time, during that piece, in the piece that was broadcast, he said, I really want to come and I want to open up music schools for the children of Palestine. And I want them to see that there's something besides the stone. There's also music. And I thought, wow, what a vision for an 18-year-old who's living in a refugee camp. You never expect that somebody's going to actually follow through, especially with such limited means. But he later got an opportunity to study in France, and he ended up living there for 7 years. And always he had this dream, which later became the dream to open the school called Al-Kamanjati, which means the violinist in Arabic. Well, I stayed in touch with him for a couple of years and then lost touch. And out of sheer coincidence, like 10 years later, it was actually the end of 2009 when I was with a couple of former students who were working as journalists in the West Bank at the time, December 2009. We wandered into a restaurant, Italian restaurant in Ramallah in the West Bank, and I hear, "Sandy, Sandy." And I'm like, "What?" I look across, and there in the corner is Ramzi, who I didn't recognize at first because he had grown a beard, and he points to himself and says, "Ramzi." And I said, and we, you know, we met and embraced, and I said, "Ramzi, you know, what are you doing? It's been so long. I thought you were still in France." He goes, "No, I'm here to open up. I've opened up a music school for the children of Palestine." And, you know, I got chills. And I, you know, when I tell that story, I've told it hundreds of times probably, I still get chills because here was a guy, I kept grabbing his arm over the dinner. He came and joined us at the table. And I said, "Ramzi, you did it. You did exactly what you said you would do." And he said, "Well, why don't you come and see our school tomorrow?" And I did. And then I didn't stop. I went back four or five times, probably six times in total, for this book, and it took me almost 5 years, but the book finally came out.
Well, it's almost faded, isn't it, that you kept running into it?
It feels that way. It feels that way sometimes.
I'm Dimae Roberts, Station Studio. I'm talking with author Sandy Tolan, who will be reading from his new novel, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. He'll be at Powell City of Books on Burnside. That's happening on April 26th, Sunday at 7:30 p.m. And you can get more info about that at powells.com or ramallahcafe.com or stationstudio.org, where I have all these links as well as photos and a podcast of this interview. You know, in doing this book, once you got the idea for this book, did you have to do, I assume you had to do more interviews. So, you know, how many times did you go back and forth and try to reconnect with the people that you had talked to during the course of doing the radio stories?
I would say, I think I counted six total trips, including that trip of in 1998. And I've been to Palestine and Israel probably 15 or more times in total. I'd say six specifically regarding research and reporting for the book. I mean, one of the challenges that you referred to earlier, Dimae, is just the detail that's necessary. I mean, in order to write narrative, and I really want people to feel like they're reading a novel, although it's an entirely nonfiction account, but in order to have the sort of gripping details of narrative that make you want to turn the page and that so that the book is not a polemic nor a kind of dry historically told account of you know, sort of dry history or another rehashing of a series of conflicts, but rather the history of this young man, this boy, this young man, and then the sort of Pied Piper nature in which he employs to get the people to, you know, to support him, and then the kids that he brings in, and then their stories. All of that required repeated trips so that I knew, you know, little tiny details that suddenly become part of the sort of narrative palette that you have to paint a picture that hopefully is not something people are going to forget anytime soon. So, you know, when Ramzi, for example, there's a kind of triumphant moment in the book about halfway through when the instruments arrive from France. They've been collected from all over France and other parts of Europe and loaded into a truck. A semi-truck, which is a container that gets then transported onto a ship, and then the ship gets shipped to the port, I believe, of Haifa, or actually is another port in Israel, Ashdod, and then transported finally to the West Bank and all the complications involved. And then there's a moment where Ramzi's standing on the back of the truck that has now been transferred to a semi, and the container is backing up down this narrow street where the music school is going to be. And, you know, I had to get all of the details of where he was standing and the narrowness. And I actually paced off the distance of when the truck had to stop because the street was too narrow. I got a list I got from accounts from various people what it was like, what it felt like, what exact instruments were in there. I looked at videos from a wonderful documentary called It Is Not a Gun, It's Not a Gun by this French documentary team, and I got additional details then. So all of, and then the story of these kids pulling all these packing peanuts out at the end of the thing and dropping them on the street and so that it looked like snow in August in Palestine. All of those things to evoke an image that hopefully people just hold not only in their mind, but in their heart and want to engage and open up to the story of these kids.
Well, and of course, the first image, which is of Ramzi as the first photographic record of the child of the Intifada throwing a stone. You have that photo in there in your book. That in of itself, in describing him as a young boy, which I assume you didn't know him back then. You knew him more when he was a little bit more grown up. But just describing what it was like for him as a child throwing these stones at tanks and at soldiers. You have a section in the book, if you don't mind doing a reading about, that would be great to hear, in which he's running away after throwing one of the stones. Do you mind reading that?
No, I'd be happy to. This is from, I believe, the third chapter, which is called Uprising, or in Arabic, it's Intifada, which literally means the shaking off, al-Intifada, but it's basically translated in English as Uprising, and that's from this chapter, chapter 3. And this would have been early 1988 or late 1987. For Ramzi, at first, it was like a game. Soldiers came, he threw stones at them. They chased him, he escaped. His favorite place to begin the ritual was a yellow stucco wall at a house on the corner of Al-Amri's main road. That's the name of the refugee camp. About 150 meters from the four-story stone building and the entrance to the camp. All across the road, he could see the white plaster minaret of the camp mosque, where, five times a day, the muazzin made the call to prayer. During the chaos of the occupation and the resulting absence of local government, the mosque had become a focal point of community life and a trusted civic institution for the exchange of vital information in the camp. Frequently, Al-Amri's news was announced over the loudspeaker on the minaret. Next to the mosque stood Karim's grocery with the overstuffed shelves where the brothers got their half-shekel chocolate biscuits. On a cold morning in early 1998, the older Shabab were smashing big rocks and curbstones into smaller pieces, good for throwing. Shabab basically means the youth. Ramzi watched them wrap their faces in checkered keffiyehs to guard their identities from the military surveillance crews and the informants, and to protect themselves from tear gas. Others deployed fresh-cut onions to dull the effects of the gas. Ramzi and the other young boys began crumpling newspapers and stuffing them into tires, the better to get them smoking. From his pocket, Ramzi pulled out the slingshot he had made from the laces and tongue of an old shoe. He preferred this for long-distance targets. The boys rotated their arms like baseball pitchers warming up at the bullpen. This way, they wouldn't get cramps. Someone lit a match. From the blazing tires, twisting black columns rose over the camp, signaling the start of another day of battle. At the camp entrance, soldiers formed an unbroken line. Often, they kept their distance, firing tear gas canisters, rubber-coated metal bullets, and occasionally live ammunition to disperse the crowds. Today, however, the line began to move forward. Ramzi wrapped his right hand around a jagged piece of curbstone. He glanced behind him to the long row of cement block homes, checking his escape route. On the rooftops, laundry flapped from metal wires suspended between posts. Crooked TV antennas poked toward the sky. He wore his blue jeans and his tennis shoes. His red jacket with the faux sheepskin collar was flying open. In his left hand, Ramzi held a rock nearly half the size of his head. His raised right arm was drawn behind him, his hand clutching the piece of curbstone. Ramzi's eyes conveyed a mixture of anger, fear, and resolve. His arched eyebrows seemed to say, "We are here." His left foot was planted, and he was stepping forward with his right. In one more second, the stone would fly. In that instant, a photojournalist snapped a picture. It captured a lone boy, one of thousands of the Atfal al-Hijra, or Children of the Stones, confronting an unseen army. The stone flew, and the chase was on. Ramzi turned and ran hard around the corner, past the stucco wall, down the alley, toward the bakery. "Stop," a voice called in accented Arabic just behind him. Elated and terrified, Ramzi zigzagged through the camp, darting left, doubling back through a darkened passage, bursting into a neighbor's house, climbing through an upstairs window, and racing along the rooftops. Still, he hadn't shaken his pursuer, who ran along below, pointing and shouting. Ramzi felt his sneakers grabbing the dimples of the tin roof. He saw his limbs pumping in a perfect rhythm with his panting breath. In times like these, in full flight from the soldiers, a strange sense of calm often settled over him. There wasn't time to put words to a prayer, but he put out the energy of a fragmented offering. God, I love you. I need you. I need to be alive. There was nothing more in the world that could help him. Once a bullet whizzed past, and he understood his life in terms of centimeters. Oddly, in these moments, Ramzi felt protected, buoyed, lifted, and cared for as he ran and ran, sprinting from rooftop to rooftop, leaping toward an imagined freedom.
Thank you, Sandy Tolan, for reading that from your book. And that's from Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. Is Ramzi's school still exists? I mean, is it still going strong?
It is still going. And, you know, they can always use help. They've had some financial struggles in recent months. And I think that, you know, they could use all the help they could get. I mean, if people wanted to go to alkamandjati.com, they could find out more about it. alkamandjati.com. They're, you know, I think that they're going to survive and thrive into the future, but running a nonprofit anywhere, much less in the occupied West Bank, is always a challenge. But what they're doing on behalf of these children is really remarkable.
Well, I'll make sure that I put that link on stageandstudio.org too. In the time remaining, Sandy, have you gotten any criticism or flack for presenting the Palestinian viewpoint for this book or any of your other radio pieces?
You know, occasionally I'll get some heat from groups that do not, or individuals who do not brook any criticism of Israel. They would be more affiliated, say, with the Likud or the Netanyahu government, and they don't want to see anyone criticize Israel in any way. And to me, that's not useful. That's not a useful way to have a discussion. I think, you know, the truth is useful. And to say what's happening on the ground, whether it's politically convenient or not, is also helpful in the end. There are some people who go so far as to say that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And I have to say, I think that's a political tactic to try to silence people. And I don't think that that's helpful for actually Israel or the Palestinians in the long run.
Well, Sandy Tolan, author of Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, thank you so much for joining me today.
Dime, it's really been a pleasure, and I'm so looking forward, hopefully, to seeing you in Portland when I'm up there in a short while.
That was author Sandy Tolan, who will be reading from his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. He'll be at Powell City of Books on Burnside on April 26th, Sunday at 7:30 p.m. And you can get links to Sandy Tolan's work at RamallahCafe.com or stageandstudio.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. We'll go out with more music by Ramzi Abaradwan. You can find links to his music and his music school at stageandstudio.org, where you can see photos and a podcast of this interview. You can also download all the shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_n_studio or tweet me at @stage_n_studio. Till next time, I'm Dimi Roberts.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
I'm Sharon Maxwell. I am a native of Portland, Oregon, born and raised in Northeast Portland. I am a product of the Portland Public Schools, and my question is, what is their commitment to children and families to make sure that children and youth of color are valued for their ability to learn and do well?
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
Up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan. His guest is Zemi Barr, the director of exhibitions at Blue Sky Gallery. They will talk about the 2015 Pacific Northwest Photography Viewing Drawers, which features 10 photos each by 62 photographers from around the Northwest.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is Zemi Barr. She's the exhibitions manager at Blue Sky Gallery, the Oregon Center for the Photographic Arts. And she's talking about the 2015 Pacific Northwest Photography Viewing Drawers. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Zemi.
Thanks for having me.